Taisha, we're on the air. Welcome to the Earth Mystery Show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. And may I, before we begin, I know you announced my name, and I don't know what kind of you gave an introduction, but I would like to state my name again, because we always begin our lectures and interviews by stating our names. My name is Taisha Avalar, and we state it because it is a dream. Sorcerers say that when a person reaches the final stages of dreaming, they are what they dream. And so Taisha Avalar is the dream that I am dreaming. So therefore, for magical purposes, we always begin by stating our names, our magical names. So
I was going to ask you to do that because I knew you would want to anyway.
Okay. Thank you. Okay.
Let me ask you, just since we're on the name, a little bit more about the name. You met Don Juan, the Yaqui Indian sorcerer who Carlos Castaneda wrote 10 books about. You met him under the name of John Michael Avalar.
Yes.
The name Avalar means what?
Well, Avalar is a name that is given to the stalkers of Don Juan's lineage. So if you've noticed, you also come across the name Grau.
Right, Florinda Donner Grau, and your teacher, or your introduction to the sorcerer's world, Clara Grau.
Yes, so the stalkers were given the name Avalar, and the dreamers were given the name Grau, and they alternate generation to generation. So even the Nawals are given Grau. The Nawal Julian was Julian Grau, and so that every other generation, the name alternates. But those are just designators as to the predilection of the person, whether he should be a dreamer or a stalker.
But Don Juan has also used the name Delos Grau, hasn't he?
Yes.
So he would be...
Grau, that is... Carlos uses that name. Carlos used the name Delos in some of his... the names really don't... We use many, many different names depending on what our purpose is. And so then... right now, I am Taisha Avalar because this is the dream that we're dreaming now. But those things change, and the names just signify the intent that has been set up. And it's like a amalgamation of a particular intent, and that name triggers that dream.
I think that I understand from my readings what stalking is. But for the listeners who don't know what the word stalking is, could you give us a brief description of what stalking is?
Stalking is really the when the assemblage point moves. Now, I think your listeners should be familiar with the term the assemblage point.
It's
that position on the luminous, when you see the luminous body as a energy conglomeration, there's one place on it that is very well lit up, and that is the center of consciousness, and sources call it the assemblage point. But when you move that in dreaming, which it moves naturally in sleep, you have to be able to keep it in a position to long enough in order to amalgamate or recognize that new reality. Because if it just shifts randomly, you have random... like in dream, your dreams just shift off. Your perception is very random. But stalking is the ability to maintain the assemblage point fixed in any particular position after it has been displaced through dreaming. So they really go hand in hand. People say, well, she's a stalker, Florinda Donna Grau is a dreamer. No, we're both. And that's why the names aren't rigid or fixed. Every dreamer has to be a stalker, because if you don't have that discipline or the ability to keep the assemblage point fixed at any particular position, then the energy is dispersed. You're unable to perceive any reality, including our own, because what we're doing now in this reality is we're stalking our world, the world of everyday life, by keeping our energy center or assemblage point fixed at a certain position, enabling us to perceive the world of everyday life. And stalking on another level is the ability to, let's say, flesh out the reality that we perceive by labeling, categorizing, creating order, and that's what a stalker does. He takes the perceptions that come to him or her directly via his energy body, and he creates order. He creates a structure that is recognizable and real, just as real as the reality of everyday life, because we are also doing stalking. Just we learned it very, very early when we learned to amalgamate perception, and we also learned to do stalking so that we could create the agreement that this whatever world that we live in is real. And sorcerers do stalking with other dream positions. So
you've done some very interesting positions from what I've gathered in your life, and if I might tell the listeners about one of them, it was Sheila Waters, the wonderful businesswoman.
Ah, yes. And you saw a demonstration of that.
I saw a demonstration of it, and if I might just tell them a small anecdote, after you were Sheila Waters and when you returned to Taisha Abelard, I came up just to play with you, and I asked you, would Sheila Waters get coffee for the men?
Ah, yes, I remember.
And you instantly became Sheila Waters. There wasn't even a microsecond of delay before you answered me as Sheila Waters, so your stalking was perfect.
It's one of our... of course, we were very well-trained. I mean, all of our adult life, really, was in the sorcerer's world, and that is what we have become. We have been dreaming different positions. Therefore, I say the names... Sheila Waters is the name of a position of the assemblage point, a dream position. And in order to be to shift from one position to the next, the assemblage point has to be absolutely fluid. Stalking maintains it, so it seems to have a rigidity associated with it, but it is not rigid the way we are in our everyday lives, where we maintain this world as the only world, through our reality is the only reality, and we are incapable of letting go, especially let's say females are tend to be more fluid in that they are not the bastions of the social order, whereas the males, because our reality of everyday life demands it, males need to be the upholders of the great institutions, which are really institutions created in the domain of intent and consciousness. Even our political systems, our religious systems, our the legal, the medical professions, all those are areas where we have put energy and we have built up, sociologists call it glosses or interpretive structures of interpretation. And those structures have to be held in place via energy and intersubjective energy in order that we can all agree what politicians do or what is done in any other aspect of life. And stalkers then would go into any of these areas and find out what is the structure, what is the interpretive system that, and the energetically, what, not just intellectually, but because we're not, of course, doing any of these things intellectually in our everyday world either. We are the politicians, we are these things. So that a stalker would find out energetically the ramifications of any of these structures and then reproduce them energetically. But going back to what I was saying, the males need to uphold those structures, so their assemblage points are very fixed, rigid, so it's difficult for them to move. They are the masterful stalkers. It's more difficult for them to do dreaming, although they, of course, they do it at night. But if they are going to be doing dreaming like sorcerers do it, they would have to go through the seven gates of dreaming, which Carlos Castaneda, in his book, The Art of Dreaming, he outlines each of these gates that a male sorcerer needs to pass through in order to move his assemblage point. Now, females don't have to go through these seven gates. They just can do dreaming very, very naturally, because their assemblage point is more fluid. And even during their menstrual cycles, the assemblage point already starts to shift slightly off its moorings, and so they women can perceive things, other things more readily that are not permissible within our social framework.
In order to get the energy for dreaming or get the energy for perfect stalking, in your book you mentioned, at least Clara told you in your book, The Sorcerer's Crossing, that a woman should be celibate. Is that true for a man also?
Well, there's this question is always charged, of course, with all kinds of attachments and emotional commitments. It depends. If it goes back to the sorcerer's conception, the idea. It's not an idea, but they have come upon it through their seeing how energetic that person is. Now, if a person was conceived with a great jolt of energy, of course, coming from his parents, then he or she may have excess energy that they don't have to be celibate. And they can use that energy to, actually, we're not saying people can't get married or have families or anything. There's other avenues that they can express their impeccability in or their sorcerer's training. But if a person does not have the energy within his own energetic body, and I mean the initial energy that he was given at conception, at birth, then it is better for them to conserve that energy and to use it for dreaming. Because sorcerers use, to do dreaming, they use the original sexual energy, and it gets transformed in the energy body. But that's what everyone starts out with, that energy, that one, the basic energy. And that's why when we talk about recapitulation, the process of regaining the energy that was spent and still caught in the past, we always begin, or we were told that everyone has to make a list of their sexual encounters, because that is the basic energy that they can then use to perform other sorcery feats, like dreaming and acquiring a internal silence. Because if you don't have the energy, you can't be silent. And that sounds like a contradiction, but our internal dialogue, it's like something was turned on, and it just runs on and on and on, and it takes energy to shut it off, because it's like a self-propelling mechanism that keeps the social structure, the social order, moving. These are our internal dialogue, if we pay attention to it, really, is a constant reaffirmation of the world as we see it, and in particular of our place in the world, of how we see ourselves, what we want. Sorcerers say now, Don Juan always says that there's a dysfunction, a deterioration that has happened, that has given too much emphasis on the self, that shouldn't really be there for our efficient functioning in our lives. Too much energy, it's an imbalance. Too much energy is being given to the defense of the self, to this, it's like a big mouth out there that says me, 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 and it just goes on and on, and the me or the I have to be constantly fed, and that takes tremendous amount of energy. All our waking hours are either deployed in defending the self, propping up the self, in the presentation of the self in the eyes of others in our daily lives, or in our mating and reproduction areas, in that we need to find love, relationships, marriage, reproduction. There's a mandate to reproduce, a biological mandate, but there's also that mandate to evolve and to reproduce. At this point, with the conditions of the world the way they are, it is almost logical or more beneficial to move that energy into the mandate of evolving and reaching some of these other positions of the assemblage point that would, in a sense, recharge the the human being, give him a jolt of an energetic jolt that he so desperately needs in our day and age, where everything is really, even the world is at an energetic low, in the sense that our resources are being depleted, and physically our bodies aren't in that great shape. So there is that mandate to evolve and use other areas of our, the totality of our potential as sentient beings, and by moving energy away from these areas of reinforcing the self-image, that looking glass self, always making sure that we don't lose face, and fighting with the petty tyrants in our daily lives, all that takes energy. So the first stage, if we want to do, we could call it sorcery, but you don't need to use that term. If we want to expand our perception, we need to redeploy energy from these areas that are really take the brunt of our life force and move it into elsewhere.
I have a couple of questions that are just technical questions. The first one is on recapitulating your life. You start with listing everybody you've ever met or dealt with, especially sexual partners.
Yes.
Then as far as the actual process goes, you take a deep breath as you, from starting with your face facing your right shoulder, and you sweep across to your left shoulder, taking a deep breath in.
Uh-huh.
Then you breathe it out as you go to your right shoulder.
Uh-huh.
Then what?
And then you move your head back to the center.
Okay. In some places, I think it was in your book, or maybe it was Carol Tiggs mentioned, a sweeping breath where you go back and forth with your head a couple of times without breathing after you've come to the center. Is that...
Yes. Now, the technical aspect of the breathing isn't that crucial. Neither is the place of where the recapitulation is done. And I should point this out, because it always comes up, well, I don't have a cave where I can retreat to for a certain amount of time and do the recapitulation. And the recapitulation is a wonderful sorcery technique that was handed down from the ancient sorcerers in order to free the energy trapped in the past, our remembered selves, our personal history. Now, that is the intent that is set up, and the most important thing of the recapitulation is to have internal integrity, an unbending purpose, and to link yourself to that intent, the intent that is already there, that is in our books, that is set up. How this is done and where this is done and when this is done, of course, has to depend on individual circumstance.
Right.
Because not everyone is out in the desert, or not everyone. So
you can recapitulate just sitting in your car as you're driving along without doing the breathing, and as long as your intent is correct.
Lorinda Donner-Grau recapitulated, did enormous recapitulation on riding through a bus in Mexico down to Oaxaca. Under horrendous circumstances, if you're familiar with the buses.
Yes, I've been on them.
But, and you do many, many different recapitulations. We're recapitulating to this day. Walking down the street, now I recapitulate. If something triggers something, or let's say you're at work and you have a break, you recapitulate there. The reason they say that you should start with a list, and ideally, you really should begin with some sort of structure, because our concentration is not that well honed at the initial stages. And the list does two things. One, first of all, we start with the sexual experiences, because, again, as I said, that is the main energy that is going to help you give you the energy to do the other areas. The list serves as a matrix for hooking your concentration, and to create a list of everyone that you've ever known in your life, that in itself takes a great deal of concentration. And in a way, it also determines, well, do you really want to do the recapitulation? People start their list and then they stop because it's too much effort, or they're not really committed. So the list sets it up. And then you go from your list and you find a place where, if possible, a place that is quiet, and put some pressure on the energy body. The luminous egg is, from the point of view of seers, is about an arm's distance from both. If you extend your arms to both sides and to the front, that and draw a circle, that is the size of the luminous egg from the point of view of seers. The assemblage point of for human beings is to the back, between the shoulder blades, and arm's distance to the back. So if you sit in a car or in a cave, small cave, or in a small closet or in a shower stall, a big box, then you notice that there's some pressure exerted on your energy body. And that is why sorcerers say that ideally it would be advisable to sit in something like that, because it keeps you alert. It stimulates the energy body. But you don't need to be, people with claustrophobia wouldn't feel at all comfortable in small, confined spaces. So they can do it anywhere at all where they can concentrate. And the breathing that is accompanied, in my context, they called it the sweeping breath, because you sweep and you actually feel like a giant broom. You feel like fiber, using your energy body, of course, you feel like a fiber is being swept free of debris. And that's a sensation that after you've been doing recapitulating for a while, that you will get, because you will become aware of your energy body. Recapitulating this technique works directly on the energy body. And yes, you can start on your right shoulder. You're inhaling and you sweep to the left shoulder. As you inhale, you pull back everything the energy that was trapped. And as you're visualizing, of course, first you have to set up the scene. That means that you see, you visualize everything, all the detail, in as much detail as possible, the scene. If you're in your living room or whatever, wherever you're sweeping something, you see the couch, the curtains, the TV, the rug, the walls, all the detail, and then you put yourself in the scene. And then you see also the people, of course, that are there. And then you just watch for a while, see what goes on, and you see yourself in action, sorcerers say. This is the only way that you really see yourself. Sweep left to right, just giving all that back. And then you bring your head to the center. Or some people begin on their left shoulder and sweep to the right, inhaling, and sweep to the left, exhaling.
Let me tell the listeners that just might have turned on their radio that this is the Earth Mystery Show. I'm Haynes Ely. Our guest today is Taisha Abelard. Taisha Abelard has written a book called The Sorcerer's Crossing. We're talking about some of the techniques described in that book. And this is KVMR 89.5 FM. I have another small technical question that has puzzled me ever since I read your book, and that is the dog, Manfred, in the book. Don Juan said that he was part of his sorcerer's party.
Yes.
And he seemed like one of the most wonderful characters in the book. Could you tell me about Manfred a little bit?
Yes. Manfred was and is, because his awareness is still
a dog
existence. No, he succeeded in going with Don Juan's party. He was an old sorcerer that tried to make the crossing. The ancient sorcerers, through dreaming, of course, they would take different forms in order to practice their dreaming, and those forms would be different positions of the assemblage point. But they, depending on their energy and their impeccability, some of them would be trapped in different dream positions, and they did not make it to the ultimate goal, which is total freedom. Manfred was a sorcerer that was trapped at a dream position, which was the energy formation of a dog. He had enough energy at the moment of death or dissolution to get into this form of a dog, so that he wouldn't be totally
dissolved.
Awareness would not be totally lost. So it was like an escape route that he used. And of course, he was profoundly was a tragic case because his awareness was so keen, but his physical form was so limited, and he would rage and rage. But on an energetic, this is a good question, because when you perceive things, we perceive them in the shape of physical forms, and we are interacting with dogs and trees and people and things, objects. But our energy bodies can perceive energy, and sorcerers, Don Juan and especially Emilito, who really Manfred was his protege, his ward in that sense, they interacted with him on an energetic level. So he was not a dog. He was an energetic energy being, an entity. And so when I was in Clara's house, something in my body, I can only explain it out of affection or compassion, enabled me to transcend seeing Manfred as a dog. I don't like dogs. I mean, I've always had a fear of dogs since childhood, when, you know, I was sort of not attacked by a dog, but, you know, a dog just sort of tumbled me, jumped on top of me, and became terrified. But there was something about Manfred, I could see that this was not a dog. There was an energetic link of pure affection, because we're both tragic cases. And in that sense, we made a pact, and we said that whoever reaches the freedom, the energy level first, will help pull the other one. And that was a pact that stays. Pacts and agreements between sorcerers or potential sorcerers, they last forever, for eternity. They transcend the realm of everyday life, because this is not the realm that we really are interested in, and we want to move out of this realm. So they have to affection and vows and agreements like that, purpose, has to transcend just the ordinary, the level of everyday life. We're not interested in giving, in terms of love, human love that, you know, is replaceable as soon as you find something better. Sorcerer affection it just stays forever. It cannot be replaced. You cannot change the head on the person, and now you're loving someone else. And no, those vows stay forever. And we have this agreement, and I'm still in touch with Manfred, because he is pulling me. He went with Don Juan when they left. When they reached a certain stage, they felt it was ready to go. It was time to leave. And they were able, because they had the mass, to pull out of the realm of everyday life, which is really saying that they had perfected all these other dream positions and their dream bodies to such a state that they could go with their awareness intact. And, of course, Manfred now is the sorcerer that he always was. But he now has the mass of other people, not people, but other sorcerers around him. But we definitely have this link, and he's helping me to be impeccable, just as I...
I love dogs, and I love dogginess, and everything that Manfred did in that book I still remember as the best part.
He would actually protect me. Yeah. And take me, show me things. And at first I didn't, at the beginning, I didn't believe it. I thought it was a dog, because our rational mind is so strong. The glosses, back to this term of the glosses that we have set up that make the world of everyday life perceivable and agreeable are, of course, so strong. We give all our energy to
the gloss
structs. At this point, in our daily life, no, human beings give all their energy to
the mask of the self,
keep the world in order.
Right.
But so therefore, we see dogs and again trees and things like that. And to break that perceptual bias takes recapitulating, takes energy.
Let me take a different tack here for our remaining 20 minutes or so.
Yes.
I'd like to, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the works of Bob Monroe. He was one of the first guests on my show, but he has written books, Journeys Out of the Body, Far Journeys, mm-hmm. Basically talking about what he would call astral travel. And his technique that he teaches people involves lying down, relaxing yourself totally mm-hmm. to a condition that he calls body asleep, mind awake.
Mm-hmm.
And during that process, you take all of your past garbage that you can think of, and you make up a dumpster or some kind of garbage can, and you visualize all that stuff, and you throw it in the garbage can, and you close the lid to try and break free of all that attachment.
Uh-huh.
And then you visualize your energy body, the luminous fibers that the sorcerers talk about, and you try and put as much energy into that as you can. And then from that point forward, you do various techniques to get out of your body, but basically you're becoming a focus of conscious awareness outside the body that can travel anywhere in the universe and do anything it wants.
Mm-hmm.
How does that differ from conscious dreaming or the sorcerer's idea of dreaming?
It does. If we look at the book, the Art of Dreaming, that's really where the whole structure of what the dreaming process is, according to our sorcery tradition. It's outlined there in great detail. So I'm going to just say here that there are many, many different stages and or gates of dreaming that you go through. Now, what you've been describing is it has similarities to some of the stages of dreaming. Yes, that first you need to recapitulate. Except this sounds like a very fast process. Recapitulating takes, you can't just visualize and throw everything into a dumpster. You have to take every situation, because energy is trapped. Every memory, every experience that we've had in our lives is trapped in at really a tissue, a cellular level, and the more we go back to the details, the more we release everything in our, let's say, physical bodies. We're not just interested in astral or energy body. So we want to first cleanse the memories that trigger our behavior as we go through everyday life in the world. Then the relaxation, yes, you first stage of dreaming, you would relax, and there's that twilight zone between sleep and being awake, and you let go of your memory of the physical body. But if the physical body is so full of emotionally charged memories, or if you can't quiet your internal dialogue, then you won't be able to relax and let go to even get into that dream state. So everything works hand in hand. The recapitulation enables you to do dreaming by focusing your concentration, by allowing your physical body to release all those charged emotions and allowing it to be empty and fluid. Then you do let go, and you can either do dreaming while you're asleep. And if you're asleep, then you have to have that control of controlling what your perception is, via finding your hands or any other object in the room. But that in itself is tremendously difficult unless you've already honed your concentration and your energy body, the awareness of your energy body. So, are you here?
Yes, I'm here. There's something weird there.
Is that from you?
No,
or from me?
Not from me.
Oh, I've changed channels.
Okay.
Okay.
On the topic of dreaming, I'm sure you get asked this every day, and that is the difference between sorcerer's dreaming and lucid dreaming.
Yes.
Could you say that in a short difference?
Yes. If you're really lucid, you're doing sorcerer's dreaming. If you have the awareness and control in your dream, then you're doing dreaming. Your assemblage point moved, and you can act in that dream as if you were awake.
Don Juan said that the universe is a predatory universe,
yep.
That there's somebody out there that wants your energy whenever you get a little bit more. And the second gate of dreaming, the world of inorganic beings, it sounds very much like that is a world that is very predatory. Is there any danger in attempting this type of dreaming without the supervision of someone who knows what they're doing?
No, you don't need the supervision of someone who knows what they're doing. What you need is sobriety and control. You yourself have to know what you're doing, because you go into these dream stages alone. Females, of course, don't have to worry, because they're so fluid. They just flow in and out. They move their assemblage points, and the universe, according to sorcerers or seers, is basically female energy. And these predators, the inorganic beings, are more after male energy. But and this is where the danger is, that you can get trapped. But the traps are really, if you indulge, if you haven't recapitulated, and you're not fluid enough to not indulge in emotions like fear or affection, because the inorganic beings, they cater to our emotions. They want to give us what we want. Inorganic beings are really just energy formations. We don't want to think of them as beings from outer space, or they're an energy that seeks energy, and if you're totally indulging and haven't recapitulated and don't have the control, then you become more or less a victim. For example, let's say if in your everyday life, we call it the poor baby syndrome. If you're always the victim and people are doing everything to you, and you complain because the world isn't giving you this and that, you have this sort of defeatist attitude, then you go into dreaming. Well, you're taking that with you. You take your energy body with you.
Isn't that poor baby me? Isn't that the modality of our time? Isn't that what we all carry in some sense?
But we all carry inside, and all our waking days, our television, radio, everything reinforces that. That is the modality of our day, and we are victims. In a sense, it is almost true, because we feel we don't have the energy to jolt ourselves out of that, and we really don't, because of our depletion, our depleted state. So it's a self-fulfilling cycle. But only by redeploying that energy of everyday life, and through, there's the sorcery passes, the movement, jolting the energy body, recapitulating, only through those sorcery techniques or not doing techniques that actually break that reflexivity, that intersubjective agreement that, yes, I am a poor baby, everyone's a poor baby. And, of course, everybody reinforces everyone else by giving solace and, let me tell you my problems, and you don't understand me, let's share our, we feel great if everyone has problems. And we really love people who are worse off than we are. But it's very difficult to love someone who's strong and happy, and here we're the poor babies, and they should be loving us. So it's hard to give affection, but everybody wants affection. But so these things have to be straightened out, have to be cleared out through the recapitulation, through not doing, through stalking yourself in the everyday life before you really tackle heavy-duty dreaming. Then if you've straightened those areas out, and if you have a strong energy body, then you go into dreaming like a warrior, like an impeccable being. And what can touch you? Because what can touch you in this world? If anything can deplete you and weaken you and call forth these poor baby things or self-importance, I'm the greatest thing that ever lived in the world of everyday life, then you know for a fact it's going to come up in your dream realities. And that was the death trap, the pitfalls of the ancient sorcerers who were masterful dreamers. They could dream, take tremendous journeys into different folds of the braid, like the different levels of reality, peels of the onion, no matter how astral plane, however you want to call it, the terminology doesn't matter. they would move their assemblage points to all these different levels. But because of egomania, they were so rigid in their assertions of the self, and you take yourself into dreaming, they got stuck there. They got, let's say, bought by the inorganic beings, and they became their slaves in that sense because of the power that they received from areas of dreaming.
Given this knowledge that the sorcerers are now distributing to the world in the form of books and talks,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't the answer be for us as a society or as a race to begin the recapitulation project in childhood for parents to teach their children recapitulation, to sit around and do it together to try and break this tyranny of the self before it ever begins?
Yes, they could break that self-importance before it begins, but not the recapitulation in terms of first the parent needs to recapitulate in order to serve as a model, let's say, for the child. Parents, of course, the child emulates the position of the assemblage point of the parent, and if whatever the parent is, that's what the child is going to copy and emulate. So if the parents, especially mothers, who are so close in contact with their children, recapitulate and, like you said, get clear out some of these areas of self-importance, then the child won't even focus on these things. They'll be doing their work. They'll be learning. They'll be expanding the perception. They won't get twisted energetically the way we have become because of a lack of awareness. You can recapitulate together with your children, but it's more advisable just to clean up your life first and then serve as an example to the child, because they don't have all that much to recapitulate.
Right. I was thinking if they just held on to their original energy so they wouldn't lose it and recapitulated starting at an early age,
yes.
They would never come to the point where they'd have to spend years recapitulating. It would be a natural thing that would just...
They go out into the world, they'll be able to see what goes on. But that really comes from the parents' awareness. If they don't have that impeccability of, let's say, giving affection without expecting things into return, not this merchant mentality that we all have that is, again, a modality of our day, that we always want something, you know, what's in it for me, then if the parents don't have, if they cling to that, then the child doesn't have a chance. But if they recapitulate and be impeccable parents, then those children will be impeccable children, and they will have what Don Juan calls perfect tonales. That is their being that is in the world of everyday life will be energetic, strong, and will have a positive outlook, and will be able to function in the world on a high energetic level rather than being defeated by the world and the challenges that we all have to face on a day-to-day basis.
What do you see the future of the world in general as, considering that the modality of the time now is the poor baby me and the merchant mentality, as you mentioned?
Mm-hmm.
What hope is there for the spirit of the world in general?
It's very bleak in the sense that everywhere you look, the egomania is rampant. It's, and you can see it. Just look for yourselves. Just open your eyes for a moment, and if we look around us at what's on television, the media, what we encounter at work, what messages are being given us via the media and our world policies, and we see that the world, our resources are being depleted, and yet we don't want to really change our lives. And so it's a downward spiral.
Could the energy assemblage point of the world itself be shifted so that all this changes in a blink of an eye?
in the blink of an eye, you would need a cataclysm. And at sorcerers say that when they see that, yes, there were times where the world, the assemblage point of the world shifted. Maybe the Ice Age great cataclysms that actually shifted, the Earth was actually shifted on its axis at one point. Some people say it actually reversed its rotation. But those, of course, are not within our conceptual range. But to shift now, you would need a total upheaval to shift suddenly. But you can shift gradually. You can, but in order to do this, you can't say, let's save the rainforest, and then you drive your Mercedes or, you know, build your house of wood or something like that. You have to start with yourself. You have to move your assemblage point as an individual and then set up a new arc of intentionality, the sorcerer's intent. As it is, we are, our assemblage points are fixed, and that spot is getting weaker and weaker. Because that the area, the position of the assemblage point was not always there on our energetic being, just as it wasn't there on the totality of the Earth itself. It has shifted over the ages, and it can shift now, and that is what sorcerers, that is our hope, and why we are addressing people at this point, because we know that it is possible to move the assemblage point, and when you do that on an individual basis, you can attract what the sources call a critical mass. Others will also be able to move their assemblage points, because now we are building a new intersubjective agreement that people who have recapitulated or who are starting are able to say, yes, I see a difference. Or people that do, if you do the sorcery passes or begin dreaming with integrity, not indulging, you can say, yes, I see the difference in how I perceive the world. And that builds up a new intersubjectivity that revitalizes. It will revitalize the world, but only if you revitalize your own energetic self. And then, of course, our children, what we talked about a moment ago, if the parents are vital, strong human beings, our children will also reflect that. And going back to the original, the how children are conceived, whether we are energetically conceived or not, parents who have recapitulated and moved their assemblage point and then have a child, have sex, and then have a child, that offspring will be energetically strong.
Right.
And so all that reinforces itself, and you can change.
I've got one question before we go. The hour is winding down, and that is, in all of Carlos Castaneda's books, and in your book, and in Florinda Donner's book, the idea of telepathy comes up, that one of the sorcerers will anticipate your question or will comment about the contents of your thought.
Yes.
At what point in the sorcerer's training does one become telepathic?
At the point where you quiet the internal dialogue. When you no longer have yourself being reaffirmed constantly in consciousness, when you no longer have worries about what's going to happen to me, or worries about your job, or worries about everyday life, when you're silent, then you develop, and through the recapitulation, when you start jolting your energy body, you develop what the sorcerers call the seer in you, or you can call it an emissary, or the voice of seeing, and that is just something that tells you, it doesn't have to be verbal, it's a feeling that, oh, they're thinking this. And sometimes you can even hear the thoughts of the other person.
You were a Buddhist monk for a number of years. You stalked the position of a male Buddhist monk.
Yes.
Does that position of quieting the internal thinking result from that discipline as well?
There's many, many meditation techniques, and the monks are over any, it doesn't have to be Buddhist, in any sect or Zen, that is their goal, to quiet inside. Originally, no, I had already done the recapitulation prior to any of this and some of the not doing techniques, so I was able to stalk these positions. But that is not to say that if you practice Zen meditation, you can't quiet your internal dialogue. There's many, many meditation techniques that shut off the internal dialogue, but that is not enough. That's one thing I would like to say, is just to have a quiet inside is fine. But what happens when you go back to work and you're surrounded by people and an angry boss, and or at home and your children and people are yelling at you, and you want to be able to have silence and equanimity and resolve in any situation. So we were always sent back into work situations, into school, academic situations, where we would practice quieting the internal dialogue, not really sitting in Zazen or in a cave or someplace where you can practice meditation. Because I know that, and I've talked to Buddhist monks now, the Tibetan monks that have come to Los Angeles, and they say it's very difficult to maintain their equanimity. And the same thing happened in China when the Chinese went up to the mountains where the Taoist temples were, and more or less turned them into tourist spots. The monks say that now that the world has entered their domain, they have destroyed some of the silence and that they have built up, which right. is true. But sorcerers saying, build up your silence, not on a mountaintop, but within yourself. And that is what quieting the internal dialogue means to us.
I think we're going to have to end at that point.
Of a city.
Our guest today on the Earth Mystery Show is Taisha Abelar. She's written a wonderful book called The Sorcerer's Crossing. I'd highly recommend reading that, and I'd recommend reading that in conjunction with Florinda Donner's book, Being and Dreaming, and Carlos Castaneda's book, The Art of Dreaming. The three of them really paint a picture that's hard to describe on the air. Taisha, after I invited Florinda Donner to come up and do a seminar or lecture or be in our area, she said she would, or she would like to, and we had a tide of phone calls and letters saying, let me know, I want to hear those people.
Uh-huh.
I'm extending the same invitation to you and to Carol Tiggs. Please put it into your dreams to come to the Grass Valley, Nevada City area, and let us see you in person.
We would love to come up there. We'll put out the intent.